Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The real-life discovery of a shuttered Parisian apartment that had been locked away for over 70 years forms the basis for a wonderful summer reading title. A Paris Apartment tells the fictionalized story of Madame de Florian, a real-life, high-priced Parisian courtesan, of which little of her life is known. But what is known was the quality of her company, like future French Prime Minister Georges Clemenceau, Marcel Proust, and portrait painter Giovanni Boldini. His portrait of the courtesan recently sold at auction for over $3 million. And this apartment, though sealed from the 1940s, was filled with high-end furniture and decorative art from the Belle Epoque. This provides the contemporary story of the novel as Sotheby's art historian April Vogt goes to oversee the furniture for auction and stumbles on a journal that imaginably shed lights on this mysterious resident who lived among museum-quality pieces. A Paris Apartment tells the story of two women, a fictionalized story of a real woman from a century ago, and a contemporary character who, through discovering the life from that century ago, reexamines her own. My guest today is a novelist and author, Michelle Gabel. This was her first novel. It's an international bestseller in hardcover. It's just come out in paperback from St. Martin's Press, and she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Michelle Gabel, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You've had this amazing journey with The Paris Apartment. It's been an international bestseller. Mm-hmm. It's probably changed your life. So now that even though you still have your day job, you're now got a wonderful book contract and things are going very well. How did this story begin? How did you discover this true life apartment that had been abandoned for 60 years?
Yes. So in 2010, the article came out about this woman who had died in the south of France, and she was 90 years old. And as it turned out, when they went through her estate, they found out that she had had this apartment in Paris. And in 1940, she locked the door, left, went to the south of France, and never returned in all those 70 years. When they went back and opened it up, the place was filled with just artwork and furniture and the most amazing treasures you could ever fathom. And one of these pieces, which was sort of the headliner item, was a portrait done by Boldini, and he was sort of the portrait artist of the era, and it was of the woman who died's grandmother, who was a famous courtesan in the Belle Epoque, that glorious gilded time before the First World War. So my agent had seen this article, and she had sent it to me. We were fresh off the heels of sort of a disappointing, I had another book I'd written, and editors were very interested in it, but as it turned out, you know, a debut author is just too hard to sell, and they didn't know kind of what to do with me because I didn't have a name. And then my agent ran across this article, and she sent it to me, and she said, you know, I think you could do something with this. I think this, you know, is something that you could really take to the next level. And it, as it turned out, I did do something with it.
What was appealing to you about the idea of this apartment? It was set vacant.
Just what was in there, that it was preserved for 70 years. I mean, even, you know, when the Germans were looting apartments in Paris, they didn't even get in there. And I also thought, you know, the two questions that I had were, A, why did the woman leave it for 70 years? What must have happened before then? How did she accumulate all these magnificent pieces? And then on top of that, what must it have been like to see it after it had been locked up for 70 years? So that's why I used the dual time periods and dual narratives of the modern day and the historical, because I wanted to answer these questions. And then also in one of the pictures, and you can Google Paris apartment shuttered 70 years and see pictures. One of the pictures shows a bookshelf with all these papers kind of shoved and stacked inside of it. And the bookshelf is kind of unremarkable. But I saw that picture and the papers in the shelves, and I decided that those were the courtesan's journals. So that's how her voice comes through in the story.
Tell us about the Madame de Florian. And actually, while this was locked up for 70 years, the pieces go back to right around the turn of the century, 1900, 1898. I think that's when the painting came from.
Yep.
And she was active as this very high-end, what you called courtesan, but there's actually a French term for it. What is the French term?
Demi-mondaine.
And this is like the highest of high-end courtesans, I guess you would say.
Yeah, we kind of would think of that as not a very prestigious position that somebody could have, you know, a working girl. But in reality, back in the Belle Epoque, they were very, like, as you said, they were the highest of the highest, and high society women would emulate their hairstyles and dresses. They were the forefront of fashion. They were the forefront of even gossip columns. I would find gossip columns. I make a reference in the book that Proust was a gossip columnist, and that's how he started. He would write about these women. And so it was interesting to me. They were not looked upon as being, oh gosh, you know, substandard, because they had the most fabulous apartments and the most fabulous clothes, and you know, they had 10 husbands supporting them instead of just one husband, so they were they could afford to be a little more extravagant. And there's some fascinating stories of these women. They were, you know, some were millionaires back then. Now some would go to Monte Carlo and gamble it all away, but others were a little more savvy with their acquired wealth.
Now, how much do we really know about the real Madame de Florian?
Not much, which made it great grounds for fiction, but she was, again, a courtesan of that era, the high-end courtesan. She did date Boldini, who had painted her, and his portrait of her sold for over 2 million euro at auction and was the highest Boldini portrait ever sold. And she did have also affairs. In my book, there's a scene where they find these calling cards with prime ministers and kings and
Georges Clemenceau, I believe Marcel Proust, all sorts of people.
And that they really did find these calling cards. So
wow.
She did have, there are documented evidence that she had these affairs with these men. And so I tried to use that as much fact as I could. And then I also found journals of a different courtesan of that era who was, you know, a courtesan turned princess turned nun. So she ran the gamut, and it helped me see kind of what folks were interested in, or what parties and what places and what people she would have been interested in during the time.
You tell this story of the opening of this sort of apartment vault, if you will, mm-hmm. through the eyes of April, who is works for Sotheby's as a art historian, and she specializes in furniture, and she's asked to go to Paris at a moment's notice to look at a apartment filled, I believe it was 19th century junk.
Yes, but that's tongue-in-cheek, because of course these pieces are magnificent, and on top of that, from April's perspective, you know, she's a continental furniture expert, she works at Sotheby's, this is her job. Not only are these gorgeous pieces, but they've obviously never been to market or been auctioned before, because they've been locked up in this time capsule, essentially. So she's fascinated by the furniture, but of course, even though she is such a furniture aficionado and knows so much, what she's most interested in are the journals that she ends up finding.
Yeah, it must have been fun putting together these journals.
What
you do through the book is you shift in time from April, going through the apartment and reading these journals, and then going back in time to read these journals. And so you create this wonderful backstory for Madame de Florian. She turns out to be a illegitimate child of Victor Hugo.
Yes. Now, that's fictional, but...
Yes. And so we pick up the story in 1898 as she's posing for Boldini, and she's pregnant with his child.
Yep.
Tell us a little bit about creating these journals.
The journals actually were the easiest part of the book to write. I don't know what that says about me, but I just found they came out so easily. It was almost like I was channeling this character. They just came out. I didn't have to do a ton of editing. I could just really feel her voice. It was very, it was just a lot of fun. And I wrote many more journals than are in the book. You know, I would just write and write and write and write, and then, you know, just put them in certain places. So it wasn't that I would, you know, write the modern day and then say, okay, what can I write a journal about? I would just write and write and write the journals and then use some of them, and some of them weren't used. It was great fun, and I loved researching that era and then finding out, you know, again, reading the gossip columns and finding out what she would have been interested in and what she would have cared about, and then figuring out where her relationship with Boldini, trying to imagine how that might have unfolded.
You know, your background's not in art history.
No.
April has a profound knowledge of art history. How did you go about getting that knowledge?
I've taken some art history over the years in high school and in college, but I did a ton of research. I read memoirs by people that work in a high-end auction world. I interviewed some people. I have a friend that used to work at Sotheby's. So shortly after the hardback of the book came out, I did have somebody email me that worked there that said that it felt like a memoir to them. So that I felt good about that.
Wow.
Because obviously I was starting from, I'm fascinated by that world. I loved delving into it. I mean, even just ordering catalogs and looking through the catalogs, something as simple as that, to, you know, very more detailed research interviews and memoirs. But I love trying to imagine what April's work life would be like, because it's so very different from mine.
One of the things becomes apparent that April has not only a fascination for this particular story, and she becomes immersed in the story of Madame de Florian and her life through these journals, but you also have a sense that she has a particular relationship with this particular time, the Belle Epoque. Do you share that?
I'm fascinated by that period because, you know, it was before the First World War, and it was the Gilded Age, and things were beautiful and wonderful, and so much art and literature and creativity came out of that period, and it was also just grand and glitzy and fun. It just is a fascinating era to me. It kind of what you don't know yet, what's to come down the pike. You know, it was just, I love that era. So like April, I do have that sort of affinity.
My guest today is Michelle Gable, who is the author of the bestseller A Paris Apartment. It's a novel, and it's now out in softcover. And it's a great summer read, and she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. If you love Paris, and Paris plays such a huge role in this book, are you a fan of Paris, or was this just writing for the book?
I am a fan. I go there for my day job with some regularity. I was just there a couple weeks ago, and I was actually in Paris when my agent called to say that the editor was interested in acquiring this manuscript. So it has a special place for me in that way. And I had the opportunity also to go there last summer with my family, with my husband and two daughters. And though I had been many times, they had not been. So it was fun to see it through their eyes as well.
Were you familiar with the 9th arrondissement, which is the neighborhood where this apartment was?
I'd been there. Not as familiar as maybe some of the other areas where I tend to, you know, be when I'm there for work. I saw the outside of the apartment, that area, walked around that particular neighborhood.
Well, what is special about that particular neighborhood?
It's more the creative, and especially in the era that the book takes place, it's more the creative, the literature, the artists, the writers, that piece of it. So it's a little more freewheeling, and it's a mix of high-end and more the struggling artist types. Colorful, I guess, would be a good word for it.
Now, one of the things, the granddaughter of the Madame de Florian, you mentioned she left when the Nazis came in 1941 and 42, left, moved to the south of France, never came back. Why do you suppose she never came back?
That's what I try to answer in the novel, of course, fictionally, and I don't want to give any spoilers, but you have to assume that something happened to keep her away because she was still in the same country. It's not that she went that far. Still very accessible from the south of France. So in my book, I tried to answer that question through my imagination of what might have happened and what would have kept her away. What was so affecting for her that she just couldn't bear to go back?
Now, in the novel, you make it seem as this apartment was just filled with objects. Mm-hmm. Was it in real life?
Yep, it was. Again, I didn't see the apartment personally because by the time the news came out, they'd already auctioned off all the items. But it was kind of, things were stacked, piled up, filled, April calls it, high-end hoarder, just crammed with things. Some of the pictures look a little more emptier than others, but there was definitely, based on the records, it was crammed with, not only artwork, but the furniture, bronze bathtubs, knickknacks, a Mickey Mouse doll, for example.
Yeah, that's really weird. There's a Mickey Mouse doll right next to a stuffed ostrich.
I love that, the juxtaposition of that. And the whimsical Mickey Mouse along with these very serious pieces of furniture.
Now, April has gone to Paris to do this job, but she finds herself at her own crossroads, and this is sort of the contemporary story. Explain what's going on in her life. She's married to a sort of high finance New Yorker. She's the second wife, and it's becoming apparent the way he found her, he might be finding somebody else, or it's certainly up in the air, her relationship with her husband, Troy.
Yep, she lives in New York with her husband, as you said, and when this job comes up in Paris, she jumps at it because she's kind of anxious to get away, and she always has looked at Paris as sort of an escape for herself. And she's just, her husband has, he had an affair, a one night stand, and he admits it to her. As soon as it happens, it's a mistake. He says, you know, look, I made this mistake. I'm sorry. It won't happen. You know, I love you. And from his perspective, he feels like I've admitted this. I've told you the truth. So, okay, let's move on and get past this problem. And April feels kind of stuck, like, wait, hold on, wait a minute here. You know, I appreciate that you told me the truth about this when it wasn't that he was found out or anything, but then it makes her question, you know, she thought that her marriage was very strong, and she just doesn't know where to go from there. Does she forgive him? Does she not? And so she's very much stuck. And then she even has sort of that feeling of, gosh, why did you even tell me? She has to make the decision, not him. And she feels like he's kind of just putting his guilt onto her and making it her problem instead of his problem. And so she shows up in Paris, and she's happy to get herself immersed in this world of furniture and art. And then she comes across a very handsome, very sly Parisian attorney who's crucial to her in that he helps her get a hold of some of these documents and diaries that normally she wouldn't have access to if she was just, you know, looking at the furniture. And she develops some feelings for him. And he's very different, of course, from her husband. And he helps her kind of come out of her shell a little bit, because she can be a little uptight and buttoned up and all business at times.
Yeah, well, explain the origin of this character, Luc Thibault.
He's some people I've met before working in Paris, for sure. And he's just, again, he was one of those characters that just kind of came to me fully formed, looking how, you know, kind of a little unkempt, but very, you know, still a businessman. You know, you can be kind of that mix of, you know, you've got the suit, but your hair is kind of messy, and she's just really, and at first she's kind of annoyed by him and his Parisian attitude, but she finds herself quickly charmed, and he's showing her things that she wouldn't normally see.
Yeah. One of the things I love about the book is it's sort of a studied guide of how Americans, you know, in the best case, can operate in Paris, because, you know, you're suspect immediately just because you're American.
Yes.
And there's a wonderful scene about how to dress to disguise the fact that you're Americans, an American, and all these sort of interesting social interactions between Parisians and Americans. Can you talk about some of those?
Yeah, well, April's particularly sensitive to that because she's American and she's proud of that, and she accepts it, but she's also spent some time living in Paris when she was younger, before she got married, and she wants to fit in. You know, she wants to appear that she fits in. She doesn't want to stick out. She doesn't want to be the American, so she dresses very, you know, she wears her black, and she has the not overly made-up hair, the overly made-up face, simple jewelry, you know, scarves, all those little pieces, and how she eats and trying to enjoy a meal, you know, or having a bigger meal. You know, now she's a little harried, so she kind of blends the American of grabbing snacks on the go, which is very not Parisian.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the more sit down, enjoy the meal, you know, savor every bite. So she is caught, and she does want to appear Parisian, even though she fully recognizes that she's also American. And she speaks the language, and she tries to speak with them, you know, as best she can, even though she realizes, okay, you know, she's obviously not Parisian, so she's going to have her American accent on it and things like that.
One of the things I liked about that line about how to dress, it was like you spend a lot of time to make it look like you haven't spent any time dressing.
Exactly. Very casual, thrown together. Oh, I rolled out of bed and threw this on, but she's very calculated about it and careful. It's definitely not a happenstance.
There's also a wonderful you were talking about dining. There's a wonderful scene where she dines alone in a restaurant, and it's like she comes at an hour when there's nobody there. And you could just see the staff go, "Oh my gosh, a single diner!" You know, and I love that. I love that little scene. What inspired that?
I don't know. I mean, I've dined alone in Paris before for work, and it is kind of, you show up early, and it's okay. Yeah, here comes an American. Or early for Paris, for us it would be a normal dinner time, and kind of that. Okay, here we go. What are they going to ask for? Are they going to be very picky? Are they going to be very this, you know, very that, very demanding? waiter, waiter, I'm not getting attention. You know, hurry up, that whole, we're not being served quick enough and the meal's not going as much of a pace as we'd want it to versus just enjoying it. And so she does try to just enjoy it and savor it while the waiters kind of look at her like, okay, what are you going to make us do here?
Yeah, and then of course we have 45 minutes for dinner, and the dinner in Paris can be an evening event. That can be the evening's entertainment.
Exactly, exactly.
My guest today is Michelle Gabel. Her first novel came out last year, A Paris Apartment, and it's been a big bestseller. It's now out in soft cover. Are you pretty much done with this book? Is it going to be a film at some point? I mean, it kind of reads like it could be an interesting film. Have you had any option interest?
We've had some interest. So I let my agent deal with that. We've had some inquiries about it for film. So, you know, I try not to think about that kind of thing and just, you know, work on the next book and the next book after that. So, and let the agent worry about those kind of things.
And you have your next book is due out next year, and again, it's set in Paris, or it sounds like it's set in Paris.
Part of it it's set in Paris and in the English countryside, in a dilapidated mansion in the English countryside.
What is the attraction of Paris to you?
Well, part of it is that the sort of the nugget that inspired my next book that comes out in February was found through the research for A Paris Apartment. So it's another woman that Boldini had painted, Gladys Deacon, the Duchess of Marlborough. Now, it's not a similar structure in terms of, you know, April doesn't go to a new auction and find new things. But she was a very interesting woman. She's supposedly the most beautiful woman that ever existed. They say she could have prevented World War I. So there's some overlap in terms of the Paris theme, because she lived in Paris independently until she was 40 and finally married at 40. And some of the character overlap, Proust, Montesquieu, and folks like that. So in that realm, that's kind of why the Paris theme continues. But, yeah. It's definitely a different type of book.
Now, I know Paris Apartment was your first book. Have you always worked in this sort of historical genre of where you're blending fact and fiction? Has that always been your passion?
I've written a lot of books before that that aren't published, and I've done a gamut from contemporary fiction, even some young adult, middle grade, but I have done quite a bit of that historical blending fact and fiction, because I love history. I love all the things you can uncover that, you know, how did I not know this about this era or this person? And then for me, when I read a book, I love when I read a book and it sends me Googling and researching things and, oh my gosh, did that really happen? Or what must this painting have looked like? So anything that can send somebody researching more, wanting to know more, I love. So I hope that A Paris Apartment does that for readers as well.
Well, the one thing, you know, a lot of times when you have a historical novel, it will be all the events of history, but you've created this whole fictional character that's sort of the unsung person, really,
right.
You know, that's the typical plot device. A Paris Apartment's somewhat different because there's really only the sketchiest of sketchy histories about this item, and you really created a really large history in along with this apartment, the existence of the apartment, and these sort of footnotes to history. So it's almost like you had this ready-made character already for you.
Yeah, that's what was so great about this particular character, because there wasn't that much known about Madame de Florian, so it made it so much more fun to write in fiction versus, you know, I'm not going to write a novel about Thomas Jefferson or somebody like that who's been studied to death and, you know, everybody, you know every little piece of his life and thought process. So, you know, that was just a lot of fun for me. I could more research the era and the people around her and the other folks. I tried to say in all the historical pieces and even the characters the characters that make brief appearances in the historical piece, I tried to stay very close to fact. For example, there's one character who's a famous, he's a performer, and his talent is farting on stage, and that he was very famous. That was true. My mother gave me such a hard time. Michelle, why would you make that up? And I'm like, that guy was actually very famous. So that part of it, I tried to stay true to the real life history.
Well, the name of the book is A Paris Apartment. Michelle Gabel, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Michelle Gabel is the author of the international bestseller A Paris Apartment, which is now out in softcover from St. Martin's Press. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. While last Friday's decision at the Supreme Court has been marked by celebrations from the GLBTQ community around the country and those sympathetic towards marriage equality, our commentator Colin Hines has been cheered by a decision much closer to home.
In the latest Oklahoma legislative session, we saw a slew of bills introduced that aimed to harass, if not guard against, LGBT individuals from being considered equally worthy human beings in the eyes of the law. With those bills came much unwanted attention and not a small amount of national scorn. To the casual observer from afar, Oklahoma continues to have the stench of backwardness about it. Recently, though, something big quietly happened here in Tulsa that should belie that perception, or so we hope. Our city council members voted 8-0 to amend Tulsa's fair housing ordinance to include LGBT individuals as a protected class. The purpose of the amendment was to ensure that a person cannot be denied housing just because they may be lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender. According to reports of the crowd in attendance at the council meeting to discuss and vote on the matter, about 10 people spoke in support of the amendment. As would be expected, the amendment had its detractors, 4 in total. Those who were against it based their opposition mostly in biblical terms. In retort to those opposed, Councilor G.T. Bynum is quoted as saying, quote, "I think it's important to point out that right now, Satanists, to go to an extreme, have more protections right now than the LGBT community in Tulsa," unquote. Councilmember Jack Henderson added, quote, "I personally feel that anybody should be able to live and get a home or an apartment because they can afford to pay for it," unquote. In direct response to one individual's argument that enacting the amendment was to condone immorality, Councilor Blake Ewing said, quote, "So, in consideration of that, if someone's track record of sin is now a qualifier or a disqualifier of whether they should be approved for housing, then none of us should be approved for housing," unquote. It's hard to argue with that. A few of those who spoke in support of the amendment pointed out that such a measure would ultimately be better for business and for attracting people to our city. Councilor Bynum concurred that may be true, but ultimately passing the amendment was about doing the right thing, he said. Mayor Bartlett did eventually get around to doing the right thing and signed the measure into ordinance. And by the stroke of a pen, Tulsa stepped into a better and bigger future instead of cravenly clawing its way back to the past.
Colin Hines is a locally based writer, attorney, and a regular contributor to Studio Tulsa. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.
The University of Tulsa welcomes the Greater Tulsa community to a wide array of athletic events, artistic performances, exhibitions, academic lectures, and symposia held on campus. Our public events are open to all. Requests for accommodation of disabilities may be directed to Dr. Tawny Taylor at 918-631-2315. To ensure availability of an interpreter, 5 to 7 days' notice is needed. 48 hours is recommended for all other accommodations.